morning, everybody. Please be seated.
To my right, our Chief Justice, Nancy Seda. To my left, Justice Mark Givens. And Justice Pickering's disqualified in this case, so that's why the Chief Justice is sitting in. And this is case number 57519, Cashel versus District Court / Layton. Mr. Goodnow, you ready?
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court, Rue Goodnow with the firm of Parsons, Bailey & Latimer, appearing on behalf of petitioner William Patterson Cashel. This case is about Nevada Rule of Professional Conduct 1.14. This rule exists to enable lawyers to assist clients with diminished capacity, the elderly suffering from Alzheimer's disease, minors under some improper influence, or as here in this case, mental illness and undue influence. Lawyers who perform their ethical duty under these difficult conditions should be entitled to normal compensation to the extent that a client is able to pay. Rule 1.14 is the primary source of guidance for a lawyer representing a client with diminished capacity. However, the rule has been criticized for lack of specificity. Although Rule 1.14 is laudable because it recognizes the rights of a client with a mental disability and requires that a lawyer maintain a traditional attorney-client privilege and relationship with such clients, the rule fails to provide much guidance to lawyers in carrying out this endeavor. Questions arise with respect to determining how an attorney is supposed to relate to diminished capacity clients, to what extent a lawyer can communicate with others with respect to the client's condition, and finally, what actions the lawyer can take without the consent of the client or even over the objection of the client. It's with this last issue that our case today deals. Given that Rule 1.14A requires an attorney to maintain a normal attorney-client relationship, the requirement of Rule 1.2 that a lawyer shall abide by the client's decisions generally remains in effect. However, an exception is found in Rule 1.14B, which allows a lawyer to take protective action without the client's consent if the following three factors are present. First, the client has diminished capacity, which was found in this case. Second, the client is at risk of substantial physical, financial, or other harm unless action is taken, which was also found in this case. And finally, the client cannot adequately act in the client's own interest, which was also present in this case.
Mr. Goodnow, I have a question. I think that Judge Steinheimer found, unfortunately, for your client, that there was no attorney-client relationship. And I think that I certainly agree with all of the focus that needs to be placed upon this rule. But that's going to be something that's pivotal for my decision-making, is how she found that there was no attorney-client relationship.
Justice Seda, may I be permitted to read from Justice Steinheimer's order for just a moment? I hate to do that. I know it's boring, but it's critical to answering your question.
We have it before us. We can follow with you.
It is in the record. The citation is PA 897. I'm beginning to quote now. It is not possible for the court to find that an attorney-client relationship ever existed between Layton and Cashel in this case. Though Cashel was acting on behalf of Layton and honestly believed he was acting in the best interests of Layton, absent an attorney-client relationship, Cashel cannot recover fees from Layton in this matter. As such, Cashel's request for $63,039.06 in attorney's fees and $7,123.40 in costs must be denied. That ends the discussion as to Mr. Cashel, and then she moves on to the trustee. I want to stress how important that is to the court's decision. The court found that no attorney-client relationship ever existed in this case, and that's critical because it is unquestioned that Mr. Cashel had a long-standing attorney-client relationship with Ms. Layton, which gave rise to this case PR 08-366. That's the probate case that they filed in order to protect Ms. Layton. And so to find that the client, who was under a disability and couldn't consent to begin with the filing of a case to protect her interests, it defined that there was no attorney-client relationship would be in direct contradiction with the letter and principles behind Rule 1.14 that permit an attorney to take action like this, like filing for a guardianship, like filing for to commence a petition for instructions to determine how to distribute money or whether to distribute money to a client. All of those things which an attorney is expressly authorized and directed to do under Rule 1.14.
So you're arguing that but for the attorney-client relationship, this case would never exist.
Right. And it continues. Here, the district court, in an order that has not been appealed from, found that the medical condition of Ms. Layton, who was the client, raises the inference that Ms. Layton was the victim of undue influence when she executed certain estate planning documents on July 24, 2008. The court found undue influence, abuse of a vulnerable person, and self-dealing. Found it. The lawyer, my client, Mr. Cashel, following reasonable investigation of the facts, acted to enjoin the improper influence and protect his client, Ms. Layton's assets. She was his client at the time, and he was her lawyer at the time, which she admitted in documents that were filed in this case and that appear in the record before this court. A timeline of the events may be helpful for the court. On March 8, 2005, a trust was formed for Ms. Layton. Marie Layton was released from West Hills Hospital in May of 2008. Mr. Butler and Ms. Murphy attempted to form a new trust for Ms. Layton and to obtain power of attorney, and Mr. Butler wrote himself a check for $100,000 out of that trust on July 24, 2008. On August 1, 2008, Mr. Cashel filed a petition pursuant to NRS 164.010 and NRCP 65. Four, he asked for three things: the court assumed jurisdiction of trust in rem, that it issue a restraining order, and that third, it issue an order to show cause for a temporary appointment of a temporary guardian. That was on August 1, 2008. At that time, the Marie Layton Trust had assets approximately of $2.3 million. The district court, in response to the petition, entered a temporary restraining order. And Mr. Cashel forwarded that temporary restraining order to Ms. Layton. Then Ms. Layton signed a statement submitted to the district court in which she described Mr. Cashel as, quote, my lawyer, end quote. That was on August 12, 2008. There was a preliminary injunction hearing held on August 15th, which the court extended the temporary restraining order. Mr. Butler, Ms. Murphy, Ms. Layton all chose not to attend the hearing. The district court entered a preliminary injunction on August 20th, finding reasonable probability of undue influence by Ms. Murphy and Mr. Butler over Ms. Layton. It wasn't until September 24, 2008, that Ms. Layton retained Karen Jenkins to represent her in probate case PR08336. And then Rebecca Butler, was appointed as a temporary trustee by District Judge Palaha. And in his order on September 25th, 2008, he found undue influence by Mr. Butler and Ms. Murphy. And it was on March 9th, 2009, when a request for fees and costs was filed for Mr. Cashel in this matter. One potential type of protective action that may be taken under these circumstances, assuming the three criteria in Rule 1.14A or B are met, is the refusal to accept the instruction from a client that the lawyer's representation be terminated. Rule 1.6A3 provides that a lawyer shall withdraw from the representation of a client if the lawyer is discharged. No exception to this provision is stated in the body of the rule. However, comment 6 to ABA Model Rule 1.16 states as follows, and this is critical. If the client has severely diminished capacity, the client may lack the legal authority to discharge the lawyer, and in any event, the discharge may be seriously adverse to the client's interests. The lawyer should make special effort to help the client consider the consequences and may take reasonably necessary protective action as provided in Rule 1.14. Rule 1.16's mandate to terminate representation of the client on request of the client is tempered by its comment 6, which incorporates Rule 1.14B's authority to factor protective action into the decision as to whether an attorney ought to follow the client's instruction to terminate representation. The scope of protective action may be taken, therefore, includes the ability to avoid termination, assuming the relevant three criteria are met. In this case, there was a complicating factor, the existence of a purported agent, Mr. Butler. Mr. Cashel reasonably believed that Mr. Butler's actions placed his principal, Ms. Layton, Mr. Cashel's client, at risk of substantial harm, thereby triggering Mr. Cashel's duty as her lawyer to act under Rule 1.14B. Therefore, Mr. Cashel was justified in taking action in violation of Mr. Butler's instructions to the same extent that he could had the instruction come directly from Ms. Layton. Section 24 of the Restatement, third of the Law Governing Lawyers, is in accord with Rule 1.14. It provides, in subsection 4, a lawyer representing a client with diminished capacity, as described in Section 1, may seek the appointment of a guardian or take other protective action within the scope of the representation when doing so is practical and will advance the client's objectives or interests, determined as stated in subsection 2. So the law does, as it should, recognize that the appointment of a guardian for the person should not be the only option, but that other types of protective measures may be considered, such as in this case, where a less invasive or expensive method of securing Ms. Layton's assets was chosen. Comment D statement says, a lawyer must also make necessary decisions for an incompetent client when it is impractical or undesirable to have a guardian appointed to take other similar protective measures. Ms. Layton was in Hawaii at the time. She couldn't be reached, and Mr. Cashel did the only advisable thing he could. He protected her assets. The brief of the real party in interest in this case ignores the elephant in the room, attempting to deflect this court's attention to non-substantive issues, timeliness of the appeal, latches, subject matter jurisdiction, and away from the real issue. Should the lawyer who complies with his duties under Rule 1.14 be entitled to payment? Our position in this case is simply that compensation is necessary to encourage hardworking lawyers to protect the rights of their impaired clients. We ask that the court issue a writ of mandate to the district court, compelling it to approve Mr. Cashel's fee application.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You have 2 minutes left for rebuttal. Ms. Muir? Or the respondent?
Good morning. My name is Gordon Muir on behalf of Marie Layton. We appreciate you taking your time to consider this matter for us. Opposing counsel has suggested in their briefs that we've ignored this issue of 1.14. I don't think we've ignored it at all. I think we've addressed it as needed in our briefs, but we just don't believe it's really an issue that's relevant in this case. There's no significant due policy considerations because we don't really get there in this case.
Mr. Muir, let me interrupt you based on that statement. Mm-hmm. Would it be then, in your opinion or your approach to the case, then wrong of me to assume that if Mr. Cashel didn't act in this case to protect his client's interest, that he might be before the state bar or this court on another matter?
I think it's quite possible. I really do. I mean, I've alleged, and I don't like to take that position, but I don't think that's really what this case is about. It's not a 1.14 issue, certainly not on appeal, partly because we don't get there. Mr. Cashel had a plain, speedy, adequate remedy at law.
Which was what?
Appeal. within 30 days of the order denying his fees. It's very, very clear. Mr. Cashel argued that there was no authority, and he cites these civil cases that an attorney can appeal a denial of fees. Well, there is statutory authority. This was not a civil case, a normal civil case of the kind that Mr. Cashel cited. This was a case brought under Chapter 164 of NRS involving trust. Specifically under Chapter 154, Chapter 155 applies. And 155 specifically says that orders denying appeals have to be brought within 30 days, quite simply. And it didn't happen. I wrote a letter to Mr. Rosenauer shortly after the time ran, wondering, we want to get the trust distributed. Chapter 132 says that the reason for these rules is to promote the quick administration of trust, settlement of trust. We want to get these things over with. That's the reason why he had that duty to appeal within 30 days. The response I got back from Mr. Rosenauer was that they seemed to think that the appeal under 155, the 30-day period, was permissive because it says may. You may appeal, but you don't have to. Well, obviously, there's a lot of case law in Nevada that says it's mandatory. You have to appeal that within 30 days. So he had a quick, speedy, adequate remedy at law. In the reply that was recently filed, there's reference to me arguing and the court stating that Mr. Cashel lacked standing in a December 16, 2010 hearing. Well, that was, you know, well after the denial of fees. That hearing simply had to do with the settlement of the trustee's account. Mr. Cashel had nothing to do with the account. And that's why I took the position, the court agreed, that Mr. Cashel, you have no basis being here. This has nothing to do with you. This is just the trustee's accounting. So he had standing to bring his case. He basically filed a petition for fees, and it was denied under Chapter 164 and 155. And clearly, he had 30 days to appeal. I was expecting an appeal. And when it didn't come, I was surprised because I fully expected an appeal from him on that matter. And like I say, my response from Mr. Rosenauer with a copy of that letter, which is in the record, to Mr. Cashel, was that they thought it was permissive, that they could wait until the final order of this case was filed. So honestly, I think they're just simply trying to do an end run with this petition for writ of mandamus in this case. In any event, Mr. Cashel's argument in this case, if you were to take his argument as it stands, it would be a case where if an attorney were to file a civil suit to recover legal fees, and that suit got an adverse decision, an attorney couldn't appeal that decision. Well, we all know that he could. I mean, you're a party to the case, and certainly the Massey-Bellmeyer case stands for that proposition, that you have to be a party to the case. And according to the standard in Massey-Bellmeyer, you have to be named and served as such. Well, he was named as the petitioner. He was one of the joint applicants for fees in this case that was initially filed. He filed the fees. He filed motions in that case. He filed oppositions to motions, joinder to motions. He noticed depositions. He wanted to take discovery. He was represented by legal counsel at the contested hearing of this matter. He was served, noticed, named, litigated, as any civil case would be. The only difference is that this was a trust matter. And as a trust matter, under NRS 132.185, he was an interested person having a claim, a creditor, against the trust. So he filed the claim, filed notices of liens, he asked the court to pay the fees. The order was denied, and clearly under 155, he had 30 days to appeal. And so he had a plain, speedy, adequate remedy at law that was just ignored, and I think inadvertently, and they, I don't know what it was, they just apparently realized or thought that they had a permissive right to appeal, and it wasn't mandatory, but the law clearly is mandatory. And again, it promotes the speedy judicial determination of trusts and estates. Now, that's one issue. So I don't even think this court can really get to this 1.14 issue because he should have appealed within 30 days. He didn't. Writs of mandamus don't lie when they have a plain, speedy, adequate remedy at law. The next issue that I'd like to address is this issue as to attorney-client relationship. And I would suggest that the court can't even go there because it's my understanding that with writs of mandamus, they don't lie when issues of fact are presented. Attorney-client relationship is an issue of fact. The Charleston versus Hardesty case was, as I understand it, was summary judgment was not granted because they felt there was an issue of fact as to the attorney-client relationship in that case. This is a factual issue. And clearly, the court already resolved that factual issue. What's this court going to do? Send it back and have her look at this issue all over again? That's really what they would have you do. Let's look at the NRS, or let's look at the 1.14 Rule of Professional Conduct. And again, one of the reasons why we don't really address that issue is because Mr. Cashel frames the issue in this case of whether or not the attorney has a continuing attorney-client relationship under 1.14. We don't dispute that. I mean, an attorney, 1.14 says what it says and is there to protect and can be used in that case. The problem in this case is the district court found that there was no attorney-client relationship. If you look at the court order, I don't have the page number on it. I guess it got cut off. But the court specifically found, number one, that there was no attorney-client relationship in this case. And while Mr. Cashel would like to think and have the court think that there was a continuing attorney-client relationship in the prior case that he was representing Ms. Layton, the court specifically found, let me just count the pages here.
It's 897 of the record.
Pardon?
Page 897 of the record, and it's the
I think it's page 6, line 25. She specifically found that Cashel was previously the attorney for Marie Layton in the 9th Judicial District in the case against Karen White. Previously the attorney. And if you look at the record, Mr. Cashel himself testified that at least as of March 2005, well, first of all, the judgment in that Layton case was entered on June 10th, 2003. He had a written contingency fee agreement that made no mention of an appeal or anything. He had a contingency fee agreement. That judgment was entered in Marie Layton's favor on June 10, 2003. He testified that at least of March 2005, his, quote, hands were off Ms. Layton at that point. He also testified that in 2008, he had effectively handed off to Ms. Layton's financial advisor, her CPA, Ms. Dane, and her lawyer, Mark Noble, the task of overseeing her financial affairs. So he had no relationship, and that's what the district court specifically found, that he was previously attorney, but it was over with.
But I guess my concern is that, and I take no issue with what you are reciting as the findings of the district court. That's clearly what Judge Steinheimer did. Went through this step by step to determine whether or not there was an attorney-client relationship. My concern here is that it was because of his duty to his client in this rather unique situation that he felt compelled to act. And that's my concern, that while this case never would have existed but for that concern and his belief that he had a continuing ongoing obligation to his client.
Well, you know, again, I think the issue, unfortunately, that, I mean, I don't dispute that these people were acting as good Samaritans, as I mentioned. But we've got to follow the law. And as you aptly, I think, recognize and counsel admitted, but for that attorney-client relationship, you don't get into this. You don't get into this. And even if you do, you know, reasonableness is a key issue here. $63,000. You know, at the time, you know, the reply states that Mr. Cashel, attorney number one, Mr. Noble, attorney number two, Mr. Rosenauer, attorney number three. I mean, how many attorneys does Ms. Layton have to pay for protection? She got her own attorney, Karen White, who I subsequently succeeded. I mean, really, how many attorneys does she have to pay to get protection here? And in fact, in a case where ultimately the protection is really questionable. And again, I don't really think, unfortunately, you really get to these issues because there was a plain, speedy, adequate remedy that he did not pursue. I believe we're getting into factual issues clearly that mandamus does not lie for. So unfortunately, I don't think you get to that issue. I just don't see how you can. I understand and don't really question the good faith that Mr. Cashel and Mr. Rosenauer, I mean, they thought they were, you know, helping somebody. But that's not what this case is about, unfortunately, at this point in time. And I think under professional conduct rule 1.14, you've got to have that attorney-client relationship. And the district court clearly found factually that there was no attorney-client relationship. Casha was hands-off at that time. We ought to be asking, why didn't Mr. Noble pursue this? If all of the financial affairs, as Mr. Casha testified, had been turned over to him, why didn't he step forward? I mean, that would have been really the attorney-client relationship that would have applied here, I think, under 1.14, but it didn't. So I would suggest that we, you know, mandamus does not lie in this case because there is no clear legal right to relief, which mandamus requires. Mandamus cannot compel an act where there's no legal duty to perform. The district court has a legal duty to find that there was an attorney-client relationship. I don't think there's a legal duty there. That's a factual issue. The court has to look at the evidence as she did. She looked at the evidence, determined that he had no attorney-client relationship, and found that no compensation could be awarded. You know, Ms. Layton opposed these actions from the very beginning. As soon as she was notified and found out what was happening, there was a notarized letter that was sent to Mr. Cashel answering various questions that he had. There was a in August, first part of August, August 12th, when this first started coming to pass. By August 27th, she was so concerned she sent a written letter terminating whatever legal representation Mr. Cashel thought that she had. She was looking.
Mr. Muir, you believe that she had the capacity, legal capacity, to function in the way that those letters suggest that she was functioning?
I believe that she had legal capacity. I believe that at the time she potentially was more susceptible to undue influence. But the fact of the matter is she did obtain separate legal counsel. After I got involved, what I did is I talked to her three doctors who at that time, and they're in the records, there's three sworn affidavits who all say that they felt that she was competent. Was she making very good decisions and judgment calls with their money back in August? Well, you and I maybe would say that she wasn't, but you know, we don't always make good judgment calls with our money. So there's really no evidence, no direct evidence, no medical evidence of her capacity back during that period of time because it didn't get to that point. And that raises the next issue that I think that I raise in this case as well on the losing end of the Linthicum case in this court that decided several years ago. That case, in my opinion, stands that for the proposition that when these issues are raised as to the capacity and that, you go to the guardianship court. That's where you find your remedy. And I didn't believe that was a correct decision at the time. The statute has since been changed because of trust in estate counsel throughout the state of Nevada, lobbying the legislature and getting a change in 2009. But when this case came down, Linthicum was the law. And this court recognized that if you have issues of capacity, undue influence, your remedy is in the guardianship court, not under Chapter 164. And so I raised the issue of subject matter jurisdiction throughout this case. And one of the difficulties in this writ of mandamus is I expected, like I said, Mr. Cashel to make that appeal within 30 days. I was planning to do a cross appeal.
Mr. Merrill, can I ask you about the appeal issue?
Yes, sir.
If Mr. Cashel was not a party to the case, you know, to these proceedings, here's an attorney coming in and acting, would he have standing to appeal in his capacity, in your view, not being a party itself or not being an intervener in it?
Well, he was a party to the case involving the request for his fees. Very clearly, he was a party. He was a petitioner. He filed a claim against the trust, and he appeared and argued and had counsel, litigated, testified. So he was a party.
So you're saying he was a party. Therefore, if he is a party, he's got to do an appeal in 30 days.
Yeah, he definitely was a party on the request for his fees. If you go back to August, it's pretty questionable. In fact, I think the quote, you'll find the district court saying, I'm not sure who the party and the attorney was back in August because the pleading lists Mr. Rosenauer, but then it lists Mr. Cashel's name on the up in the upper left-hand corner, and it was kind of confusing who was representing who and who was the party for who. But again, all of those issues certainly would have been avoided by going through a guardianship proceeding.
Thank you.
I guess my time's over, so.
Yes. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
So good, now you have 2 minutes left.
Thank you, Your Honor. This case really, from the standpoint of whether or not appeal or a petition was proper, really is controlled by Bellmeyer. Mr. Cashel couldn't appeal. This court's precedent is directly on point. He was not a party. He an attorney who wishes to proceed from a denial of attorney's fees needs to go up on a writ. This court's precedent has been clear.
So, in the Bellmeyer, you don't feel that the proceedings, Chapter 1, was 54, 55, the different chapters involved here, make it an appealable process then?
That's correct, Your Honor. Just because an order is an appealable order doesn't mean that you have standing to appeal from it. That's, I think, one of the things that respondent's missing here. The Albany versus Arcata Associates case on which Bellmeyer's based, 106 Nevada 688, is also in accord with that principle. Judge Steinheimer ruled that my client petitioner had no standing during its arguments, and so how could we appeal? The Supreme Court, this court already determined in its February 10th order that we had no plain, speedy, and adequate remedy at law. I think we're properly here on the writ. The question of whether or not Linthicum applies is an issue that the respondent did not appeal. Clearly, Linthicum didn't apply here. We chose, as I mentioned, under Rule 0.14, the least restrictive, least invasive method of protecting the client. My client did, and so he should be compensated for doing that. It was the appropriate thing to do under Rule 1.14. The question of capacity, Justice Sada asked about that. It's important to note that in the record are the what were originally unsigned affidavits by three psychiatrists from the Bay Area, which tell volumes about capacity. One of them indicates that that Ms. Layton had been under the psychiatrist's care and treatment, and then upon being discharged was in stable condition. Well, if she was under the care and treatment at the time of this psychiatrist, obviously that says that she lacked capacity during the relevant time frame. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Muir. Mr. Bidnell, thank you for your excellent arguments and briefs in this matter. This matter will stand submitted. And we'll recess to the next call of this panel.